The first Mercedes overtook the Renault on the driver's side, speeding past and blocking it off at an angle. The second Mercedes swung in from behind and blocked off any chance of escape. The American lived in a cul-de-sac and was now completely boxed in. He glanced at his attaché case. With AK-47s held at the ready, the masked man approached the car, barking orders in Arabic. They had rehearsed this before. It took all of a handful of seconds in the blink of an eye, and with the barrel end of a Kalashnikov to his temple, the American vanished into her Mercedes. I was assigned to the hostage location task force at the CIA. There were primarily three of us, and it was a full-time job to try to locate the hostages. But make no bones about it, President Reagan and others said, find Bill Buckley. If you can locate Bill Buckley, you can locate the other Americans and the Westerners that were held. It was one of those moments very similar to when Ambassador Stevens was missing in Benghazi, when there's a sense of dread that just overtakes the entire nation and the entire intelligence community and grinds everything to a halt.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a very special guest on with me for this podcast, Mr. Fred Burton. How's it going?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for coming on. So you've been working in the world of counterterrorism and for a long time, but you started working for the State Department. Can we kind of talk about it from the beginning and then After talking about your career in the government, just kind of walk through what you've been up to since then?
Be happy to. I was a police officer first outside of Washington, D.C., in Montgomery County, Maryland. And then we used to have the Secretary of State that lived in our district. And so I knew the State Department had these agents that weren't like the Secret Service, but they did something. No one was really sure what they really did. So I did a little bit of research and decided to apply to the State Department as a special agent, and was lucky enough to get hired, John, after the embassy bombings in Beirut, when a commission was put together and they decided that the State Department needed hundreds of more agents. So, you know, a lot of it was timing. So I went as a cop to being a special agent. And then right out of basic agent training, I was assigned to the counterterrorism branch of the State Department. And at that point in time, we had three of us. There was just three of us for the entire world. And yeah, that's also kind of an indictment of the kind of focus in the 80s there were on terrorism. But and because I was the youngest in the group, I was given the Middle East, and so anything that kind of blew up, or any terrorism investigations or hijackings or hostage takings that took place out of the Middle East, I was either involved with, engaged with, or investigating.
And did you ever work with other agencies or military in involving any incidents out of the Middle East?
Oh, yeah. We were consistently working hand in glove with either the CIA, the FBI in certain cases. So early on in the 80s, the FBI actually did very little terrorism investigations overseas. Most of the work was done by us. We were the organization that no one ever really heard of and had been around since 1916, but we just didn't have the publicity or the agents assigned to lobby for additional resources or so forth on Capitol Hill. So, but the State Department's been involved in the protection of Americans and the investigation of terrorism for a long time, even going back to the 60s and so forth.
Okay, so how long did you finish your career in that capacity?
No, I didn't, John. I spent several years there, actually almost 15 years doing nothing but terrorism investigations. And, you know, I worked over at the CIA on the Hostage Location Task Force when the hostages were missing in Lebanon. I went over to FBI headquarters for a while, then bounced back to state. I had spent enough time in the business that my career had kind of plateaued, and I knew it was time to go. I was also involved, and I've actually gotten much more credit than I deserve for this, but I was involved with the capture of Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. And I ruffled a lot of feathers with that case because we didn't play by the rules, and Washington can be a very vindictive place. So I kind of knew my career was over, and you know, I left, and so now I'm in Austin, Texas, working for Stratfor, which stands for Strategic Forecasting. It's a private intelligence company, and we try to make sense of the world. We cover geopolitics, terrorism, economics, and so that's what I do now.
And you also host the Stratfor podcast?
I do. I have my own podcast series here at Stratfor. It's called The Pen and Sword, and we interview authors that put together books on geopolitics or international relations or terrorism or espionage. So I spend a great deal of time doing that and then working on my books and, you know, writing for our website.
Right. So you've also written several books as well, right? Can you just drop the titles of those books for the audience?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My first book was called Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent, which talk about my career in the 80s on up into the 90s. And then my second book is called Chasing Shadows. And this is a story of an Israeli intelligence officer that was murdered in my neighborhood when I was a kid. And I went back and looked at the case and figured out what happened and who did it. The Israeli was the military attaché assigned to the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. And he was gunned down on the front lawn of his house, and his wife and children watched him die. It was just a horrible event. And then my third book is about Benghazi, and it's called Under Fire. It was the first book I've ever had, which was a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller, and HBO optioned that for a made-for-TV film. And then my last book that's out is called Beirut Rules, and it's the story of the only CIA station chief to ever have been kidnapped and murdered.
Right. And I would like to, later on in the podcast, I would like to get into the Beirut Rules, as I do find that sort of a fascinating and important part of our history, especially related to counterterrorism and other things that we're dealing with today. So I wanted to ask you about the development of modern terrorism. It kind of seems like there are more terrorists now than there were 20 years ago. So what I was wondering is this just that there's always been violent groups out there in the world and they're just falling in line under one banner? Or is it that they're falling in line under this type of ideology of like an Osama bin Laden or guys like that?
Well, it's really a good question, John. When you look at the history of modern-day terrorism, at least going back to the 60s, we actually had frightening numbers of terrorism inside the continental United States in the late 60s and also into the 70s. And a good bulk of that was funded and sponsored by the Soviet Union. and their efforts were to try to destabilize America. So, you know, you're looking at the groups like the Black Panther Party, you know, the Cleaver faction of the Black Panther Party, the Weather Underground, and so forth. We had a tremendous amount of bomb threats, bombing of police stations, multinational corporations, and then, of course, you know, the horrific assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and certainly Martin Luther King, and the list just continues. So terrorism has been around forever. And when I first got in the business, you know, clearly everybody remembered the Munich massacre, which was the 1972 murder of the 11 Israeli athletes in Germany. And that was somewhat of a game changer, because that act of terrorism kind of developed a special operations capacity, your notion of counter sniper teams and SWAT teams. And then in the early 80s, we certainly had global terrorism, you know, with the likes of the radical Palestinian groups like Black September, the right. Abu Nidal organization, and so forth. So when you step into the history of terrorism, you know, kind of all roads lead back to Black September and the Munich massacre, and then that springboards into Hezbollah, which is directly Iranian-backed and sponsored. And then, of course, that leads us into Al-Qaeda. So for your listeners' sake, you know, if you focus on those three major groups, Black September, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda, you know, that's a good bulk of modern-day terrorism. But, you know, terrorism has been around for a long time.
Right. And so Black September, after the Olympics, the Israelis went after them, and they were successful. I think often they did make a mistake, and I think they ended up killing the wrong person. If I remember, I think it was in Switzerland.
It was in Lillehammer. My book, Chasing Shadows, talks a lot about that, because the Israeli intelligence officer that was murdered in Bethesda, Maryland, was actually murdered by Black September.
Really?
Yes, and he was part of the tit-for-tat shadow war that was going on between the Israeli Mossad and the Black September organization. So Black September carries out these horrific attack in Munich. The Israelis stand up what was called the Wrath of God squads, and they go out and they start targeting all of the Black September leadership operators, and one by one killing them. A little known fact after that was the Palestinians were doing a pretty good job of utilizing double agents and actually shooting and killing Israeli intelligence officers, to include Colonel Joe Alon there in Bethesda, Maryland, in my neighborhood. So, there was a period of time, John, that Black September, in about a 2-year reign, had more Israeli blood on their hands than, you know, any other terrorist organization in history, just with the pace and the tempo. And really, they were quite good at killing Israelis.
So did they have any kind of backing from a major government like the Iranians or something? Like, how were they so good at what they did?
Well, a lot of it was the error and the lack of technology. You know, you have to think back. When I first started, we were using 3x5 index cards and typewriters. We didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones. We had old fashioned Motorola beepers. So if you go back 10 years before that, Black September was able to move around Europe, you know, buying weapons at will. They had a lot of support in those days by Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and getting identity documents. They had support from the Libyans as well as the Algerians. A lot of them actually were roaming around the world with Algerian diplomatic passports. So they were getting a lot of nation-state support, which is critical when you start looking at a counterterrorism strategy. You know, that's why you know, state sponsors of terror, nation state sponsors of terror, are always very difficult to kind of stay in front of.
Right. And so I know when the Israelis went after them, they were targeting them all over Europe. They were catching some of these guys.
They were. They were doing some very brilliant operations, putting bombs in under beds, in vehicles. They actually put an improvised explosive device in a phone. They did, you know, their mission was twofold. One was vengeance, to get even. But they also wanted to disrupt other terrorist attacks that could have been in the works and planned by the Black September organization. But, you know, Black September was operating as kind of a secret wing of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization at the time. And it was basically Arafat's covert intelligence service to kill Jews. And they pulled off some spectacular attacks.
Yeah, they did a lot of damage. And I think looking at Arafat as well, some of the early instances of sort of what we call now like IEDs or bombs left on the side of the road was really Arafat attacking the Jews early on, when he was a young man in the Middle East.
And it was very ironic. I'll tell you an interesting story. In 73, Golda Meir made a trip to New York City, and Black September put three car bombs in New York that fortunately did not detonate. One was at an Israeli bank. Another one was at El Al, the airport at JFK. And another one was in Midtown Manhattan. And then ironically, you fast forward to the late 80s and the early 90s, I ended up working a lot of protective details, protecting Yasser Arafat whenever he would come to New York City for events or to Washington, D.C. So, you know, the irony of one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter was just kind of interesting. So it was just very odd, the kind of world that you lived in that time period.
So you said you were involved in capturing one of the guys who was responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing. Did that happen stateside, or were you led to the Philippines at all?
We're talking about Ramzi Yosef, who was the very good bomb maker. In fact, he was bin Laden's favorite bomb maker. He had blown up the World Trade Center the first time in 93, escaped, and he had placed bombs on planes. And he went to the Philippines, where he was planning to assassinate the Pope. Right. But as luck would have it on our side, he actually started a fire. The fire department came, the intel service came, and lo and behold, we were able to piece together through cooperation with the Philippine National Police that this was Ramzi Yosef. And so he went back on the run, John. And what happened was we developed an informant using the Rewards for Justice program, the $20 million that most people know towards bin Laden. In those days, it was a $2 million cap. So we used the Rewards for Justice program to develop an informant to tell us where Yosef was. He identified him being in a hotel in Islamabad, Pakistan. And that's where Ramzi Yosef was captured by special agents of the State Department.
I see. Okay. And so some of the other guys involved, were they captured stateside?
Yes. Early on after the first World Trade Center bombing, there were at least one, if memory serves me correct, that was picked up in the United States. I think his name was I just can't recall his name. I'm having a senior moment, but there was a couple picked up here, and of course they were tied into Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the blind sheikh, who was at the Brooklyn Mosque, and he was ultimately arrested for sedition and put into federal custody, and he died not too long ago, actually. And then the rest of them kind of scattered to the winds, but Yosef was the brains and the operational commander of that bombing, and there's no doubt in my mind he would have killed more if we had not picked him up. And in fact, when he was in Pakistan, he was actually planning attacks against the U.S. Embassy and the United States ambassador there. So we got very fortunate, as occasionally you get in this business, by just getting lucky, getting an informant that was very successful in helping us bring Yosef to justice, and he's serving life at the Supermax in Colorado.
Right, and he was connected to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who later on was kind of masterminded the 9/11 attacks.
That's correct. They were all interconnected, and there might have been actually some family nexus between Yosef and Khalid Sheikh right. Mohammed. We had opportunities, unfortunately, that we somewhat squandered to capture Khalid Sheikh Mohammed before he was ultimately arrested. But, when you step back in that time period, especially before 9/11, John, it's hard for people to understand how limited resources were devoted to terrorism from a national security strategy. You did not have your fusion centers. You had only a handful of joint terrorism task forces. There was no TSA. There's no priority placed on combating terrorism by the U.S. government from a foreign policy perspective in those days. So, you know, it took the strategic strike by al-Qaeda on 9/11 to kind of reshape and refocus national security priorities to make terrorism an issue.
Right. I mean, before 9/11, the things you can bring on aircraft, the planes, and the security was so low, as you know, regarding airports and things like that. And I think one of the failures that led up to 9/11 was different agencies weren't speaking to each other and sharing information.
Oh, that's right. We had horrendous turf battles. Most people would be shocked to know how bad they were at times. And of course, there was another historical moment. I mean, I worked on the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and we lost some of our agents on that flight. And that was a Libyan-backed attack, state sponsor attack, Libyan intelligence service. And in those days, literally, you had bags going onto aircraft that were not screened for bombs. So I know it's hard to believe in our post 9/11 world, but that wasn't too long ago.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Just kind of looking back, like I can't even remember what that must have been like compared to now. Like, I travel a lot myself, and I'm also a photographer, so I bring all my gear with me, and it's such a hassle. Like with TSA, you got to open your bag and bring your laptop out and show them all your gear, and you know, before you're allowed to get on the plane. So I just can't imagine guys can just bring, you know, duffel bags loaded with bombs onto the aircraft. It's insane.
It really was, and if you look back at some of the earlier hijackings from that time period. Pretty much the hijackers just smuggled the weapons aboard the aircraft because they just weren't screened. And, you know, we learned our lesson at Lockerbie over why you need to screen for bags going into luggage holds. But, you know, it took Lockerbie to change how we screen for bombs going into planes. And I'm sad to say it took 9/11 you know, to shift a national priority and focus into these organizations like Al Qaeda that, you know, were hell-bent on just killing innocent Americans.
Right, and they'd been running attacks and operations in Africa and overseas for a couple of years before 9/11.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, going back to, you know, I trace the beginning of this to the assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahane on the streets of Manhattan by an Egyptian terrorist by the name of Al-Sayed Nasser. And Nasser was also tied into the blind sheikh at the Brooklyn Mosque. And, you know, this kind of preceded the first World Trade Center. Then we had that happen. And then after that, we had a whole range of different kinds of Al-Qaeda-sponsored attacks and plots. And you see, also, you only see the catastrophic results of failure. But when I was in the saddle as the deputy chief of the counterterrorism division, you know, for every real legitimate threat, I mean, for every real legitimate attack you had a dozen other threats that you were always trying to mitigate and look at around the world. And so, you know, and you only see the results of some of the successful operations by Al-Qaeda at the time.
Right, right. So I wanted to get to the second half of the question where we're talking about now there seems to be more terrorists than there were 20 years ago when 9/11 happened. And is this just that there were always violent groups around the world and they have something to sort of rally around, or are they buying into this radical ideology?
I think it's a it's an interesting question that you could probably do a PhD thesis on. I think that we've always had violent groups in the world. I think that they're amplified or magnified by social media, the 24/7 news cycle, Twitter, Facebook, the dark web, whatever. When you start looking at the expansion of organizations, especially when you are looking at failed states such as Syria and others, it's a challenge to actually get your arms around numbers and so forth. But clearly, you know, there is a tempo that's been there that's kind of been, you know, I've been in this business since 1981, and it's just always been there, and it kind of ebbs and flows and so forth. But I think the scary part for me is when you start looking at this is, you know, these organizations seem to, at times, they're able to identify those vulnerabilities in U.S. security measures, whatever they might be, and take advantage of them over time, whether that be, you know, using something as simplistic as box cutters and flying planes into buildings to attacking U.S. Navy warships, like at the USS Cole, to going after vulnerable houses of worship, like various synagogues, you know, in BA Argentina. So they seem to, you know, always look at those vulnerable aspects of society and are able to strike.
Yeah, I think people generally, like from the public's perception, I mean, maybe most people aren't thinking so much about it, but the thinking that people do regarding it, I don't think they give enough credit to how clever some of these groups are and how sort of thinking outside the box, you know, things that they're doing that really are effective against a military power like the United States.
Without a doubt. I vividly recall in 86 going out to a rocket attack at the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, Spain. And this was carried out by the remnants of the old Japanese Red Army. And that individual used a homemade rocket launcher and almost put it through the window of an embassy. Thank goodness it didn't, or people would have been killed.
Wow.
And shortly thereafter, he was picked up by the New Jersey Highway Patrol, New Jersey State Police. On the New Jersey Turnpike, he was bound for Manhattan to blow up a U.S. Naval recruiting station. So, you know, these folks can move and they adapt very well to their surroundings.
And you said this was a Japanese guy?
Yeah, his name was Yu Kikamura, and he was a Japanese guy that was one of the remnants of the old Japanese Red Army, and he was you know, very methodical. He, besides attacking the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, he also attacked the U.S. Ambassador's residence in Jakarta by using a pretty similar M.O., you know, rockets launched, homemade rockets launched from a homemade rocket launcher.
So what was his deal? He just he had some sort of hatred for the U.S. for World War II? Is that it?
No, his deal was more he was part of the leftist anarchist wing of you know, you've got the subset of organizations at the time, like the Japanese Red Army, the Red Army faction, the Italian Red Brigades, and so forth. They were more Soviet-backed. They were anti-American, anti-imperialist, and anarchist slash terrorist.
And these guys were like left-wingers?
For the most part, yes. Leaned towards, at times, communism, socialism, but they're also pretty good criminals. You know, when they weren't putting together terrorist operations, they were also kidnapping CEOs and robbing banks.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. So I wanted to ask you about the assassination of an Israeli statesman. His name was Yitzhak Rabin. I'm probably butchering the name, but
it's Yitzhak Rabin.
Yitzhak Rabin, okay.
Yes, Yitzhak Rabin was the prime minister of Israel, and in 1995, he was assassinated by a ultra-nationalist right-wing Jew in Israel. He had come out of a speaking event and was walking to the motorcade cars that were queued up. And a lone gunman, literally, that was lurking around the departure point, pulls out a Beretta and fires several shots into the prime minister and actually hit one of the Shin Bet security officers. And that was really kind of a fascinating case. I led a task force looking into that because we were concerned about possible nexus and links to the United States. Because the assassin in Israel that killed Rabin had links and nexuses back to the United States. And then we had very right-wing, hardcore Jewish nationalists in the United States during that time period of the Middle East peace conferences. And we also had protected Prime Minister Rabin on several visits to the United States. So we were concerned that perhaps some of these radical right-wing Jewish groups were planning to carry out additional attacks on Israeli protectees, predominantly in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Miami. So it was a fascinating case. It clearly was, you know, speaking of 9/11, for us, you know, for the Israeli intelligence services, after Munich, they got pretty good at focusing on Palestinians and Hezbollah, but then they didn't focus on the radical Jews inside their own country. So it was a wake-up call. It was their 9/11 when the prime minister was assassinated by an Israeli national.
So that's pretty interesting. So these guys, so the guy who assassinated him and those some of those other radical groups, were they like Hasidic Jews who were, you know, against any kind of peace talks with the Palestinians?
They were against land for peace, meaning Rabin was big on trying to, create peace with the Palestinians, and the radical right-wing Jews did not want to give up any land for peace. And they were, an offset of a group called Kahani Chai, which means Kahani lives in Hebrew. And at one point, they were headquartered in New York City in Brooklyn. But after the assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahani, they relocated to Israel. And so, in essence, what happened inside the Israeli intelligence services is they never thought a Jew would kill another Jew.
Right.
So this was kind of like their 9/11 moment that, they had a real problem with the right-wing Jews inside of Israel. So, as evidenced by the assassination of the Israeli prime minister.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't really give sort of the attention to the fact that in Israel, people are kind of divided on how they should move forward regarding any kind of peace with the Palestinians. It isn't like everyone's on the same page about it.
Oh, no. There's horrific divides inside of Israel, which, reach back into inside the United States. And, it was the equivalent to, the assassination of JFK for us here in the United States, John F. Kennedy, when Prime Minister Rabin of Israel was assassinated by, an Israeli national.
Yeah, I was in Israel over the summer, and I was there for, maybe 8 days or something. And, I spent time in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And you can almost feel the difference. Like, Tel Aviv is kind of more of a laid back, relaxed. To me, it kind of felt like almost like a Miami vibe with the beach there, and there's a lot of partying and stuff like that, and restaurants and things. But when you get to Jerusalem, there's more neighborhoods of like Hasidic Jews, and you can sort of feel the difference in the air. It's almost hard to describe.
No, I know exactly what you mean, and that's very well said. But I'm sure you had a nice trip.
Oh yeah, it was amazing. Israel was really interesting place. And then, of course, from Israel, you take tours into the West Bank and you visit some of those old historic sites. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, nice place to visit for sure.
Yeah, and the food is really good.
Awesome, I know.
Yeah. Okay, so you have your most recent book is Beirut Rules. But you also brought up the book where you wrote about Benghazi. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure can. You want me to kick off with the book about Benghazi?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I felt very sorry for those five young special agents that were in Benghazi. And having come from the same organization, and I knew that they did the best job they possibly could in a very difficult circumstance. And there's two books, and I tell folks this all the time. There's a one book called 13 Hours, which the movie was made, and that's the CIA book, or those individuals that were working for the CIA that came to the special mission compound where Ambassador Stevens was, and, as backup to help the State Department agents and so forth. But, 13 Hours is the CIA version of events. And my book, Under Fire, which I co-wrote with Samuel Katz, it's the State Department's view and assessment of what took place there. So if you read both, you get a pretty good handle of what took place in Benghazi. I learned a long time ago, John, when doing books, none of my books are political. I don't take a stand one way or the other. I just lay out the facts and let the reader reach their own conclusion as to what happened.
Right.
But, Benghazi, Ambassador Stevens never should have been there that day. That's for sure. There was a little bit of human error on the part of the agents that were there, meaning they did not have smoke hoods in the safe haven. And a smoke hood, I'm staring at one in my office, is this device that you put over your head that provides you good air, oxygen, to get yourself out of a smoke-filled building. Mm. I know a lot of people in New York City that have them in their offices and carry them in their bags on the subway. And so that was a little bit of human error there. There had been so many agents rotating in and out on protection assignments. Nobody checked for smoke hoods in the safe haven. I think that would have made a difference. It very possibly could have saved Ambassador Stevens' life, as well as Sean Smith, the communications officer that perished due to the smoke inhalation as well. So what I found, and you know, some of your listeners may not know this, but in 1979, we had, of course, the famous hostage takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, but we also had a U.S. Embassy overran in Islamabad, Pakistan, that was also set on fire. And that was kind of lost in the Benghazi, you know, the nasty politics surrounding Benghazi. But, you know, fire is a weapon, can be very effective. And, you know, we learned that lesson in 79 in Islamabad. And, you know, unfortunately, we also learned that lesson in Benghazi.
Yeah, obviously, in the aftermath of Benghazi, it's been highly politicized. People sort of pointing their finger, and it's one of those things that obviously was a terrible tragedy, and I'm not exactly sure if the green light was given to some sort of response force. If they would have even gotten there in time, maybe they would have. I'm not really sure at this point, because people say so many different things. It's hard to decipher what's true and what isn't. But it's certainly been heavily politicized, and I think that using politics in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy like that is just wrong, you know?
Well, I agree with you, John, and that's one of the reasons that we put this book together. We wanted to lay out the facts, let the reader be the judge as to what happened. You know, in reality, on a practical level, you had five highly trained State Department special agents, you know, right down the road, less than a mile away. You had a damn good backup team of CIA ground branch personnel, you know, all former Marines, Green Berets, and Navy SEALs. So, you know, you had resources in country. What you did have, though, quite frankly, is a intelligence failure with the inability to predict or forecast or have that human intelligence to tell you that this was going to take place. So, you know, most tragedies boil down to a human intelligence failure. At least every case I've ever worked, it boils down to that. You know, you lack that human intelligence to tell you, you know, who's going to pull the trigger, or who's going to build the bomb, or where the bomb's going to be. And, you know, it just goes to show you that, you know, for as much money as we spend on the U.S. intelligence community, you know, we still have vulnerabilities.
Right, right. Okay, so let's see here. Okay, so now I would like to talk about your book, Beirut Rules, and I think it's very important, the topics that you covered, because they lead into other things moving forward on how the U.S. dealt with Iran and things like that. So can we sort of talk about your book, Beirut Rules?
Sure can. Beirut Rules is a story of the only CIA station chief ever to be kidnapped and murdered. And I worked on his case when I was a State Department special agent assigned to the CIA. And the chief of station was named Bill Buckley. And it's important to put this in context because, you know, we had in April of 1983, we had the U.S. Embassy leveled by this group called the Islamic Jihad Organization that we really had no idea who the hell they were. And they pretty much took out the eyes and ears of the U.S. intelligence community in the Middle East. And because the bulk of the CIA station was blown up there. And so Bill Buckley, who volunteers to go to stand up the U.S. intelligence operations in Beirut after this horrific bombing, he ends up getting kidnapped himself. So he was part and parcel to a whole laundry list of Westerners that were being kidnapped. And of course, we were paralyzed in Washington because not only do you have one embassy bombing with this horrific loss of life, then you have the U.S. intelligence officer, the senior most U.S. intelligence officer, kidnapped. We have no idea where he is. Then while he's in captivity, we have a second embassy bombing, which, you know, levels the U.S. embassy again. So, you know, Bill Buckley, who he's one of these guys that was always all in, John. You know, as an 18-year-old, you know, he volunteers right out of high school to go to the Korean War, where he's awarded the Silver Star and Purple Heart for rushing a machine gun nest. Wow. And then he comes back from the war, goes to Boston University to get his degree, then volunteers to go into Special Forces and becomes one of Kennedy's first Green Berets and is shipped off to Vietnam.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, where he was awarded a second Silver Star for gallantry under fire. And a host of other, you know, commendations, and then joins the CIA. So, you know, his CIA career was very storied. You know, he's a paramilitary officer. He's bouncing all around the world, going to all these hot spots. And then after the horrific embassy bombing in Beirut, he volunteers to go because that's just the kind of guy he was.
Wow, I did not know he was in Special Forces. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he was a Green Beret. I've got a there's a great picture of him in the book, and I'm staring at it here in my office of him with his Green Beret on what appears to be inside a C-130 somewhere in Nam. And the interesting part when after my Benghazi book was done, I approached the CIA and I said, look. I want to tell Bill's story. You know, Bill's the 51st star on the wall of honor at the CIA as you enter. And I said, you know, this is a guy that could inspire a generation to want to serve their country, but we need to tell his story, and I want to tell it. And the agency said, you know, we love it. How can we help? And they declassified a lot of his records. And then I've learned to get the family on board, so I approached the family, and Bill had two very elderly family members. They were a little bit reluctant at first, so they realized that, you know, I was one of the good guys, that I just wanted to tell a story about their brother who was a hero. And they got all in, and they turned over a treasure trove of, you know, original pictures of Bill and pictures of Bill when he was in Vietnam. So I was able to tell the personal side of the story. And, you know, for me, you know, the family loved the book, and I was very honored to get a testimonial about the book from President George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, before he passed away. I don't think I would ever be able to beat that kind of testimonial for any other book. But, you know, I think President Bush recognized that Bill Buckley was a lot like him from that same generation, you know, that put service first.
did they know each other? I know President Bush, he served in some capacity at the CIA.
Yes, he was the CIA director, and I have no direct evidence that they ever met, but after Bill Buckley was kidnapped, of course, President Bush, you know, would have known all about that.
Right.
And but I don't know the answer specifically to that question.
That's pretty fascinating. So the same group that bombed, that were bombing these buildings, were they the same people who kidnapped him?
Yes. This was we were able to ultimately figure out that the Islamic Jihad organization that had blown up the embassies and the Marine barracks in Beirut and hijacked TWA Flight 847 and killed a U.S. Navy diver by the name of Robert Stedham, that this group was actually Hezbollah, and they were operating under, they were a tool of foreign policy of Iran, and they were being utilized to pretty much create havoc for the Americans in an effort to drive America out of Lebanon. And quite frankly, they were very successful at killing. And, you know, before Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda came around, Hezbollah had more U.S. and Israeli blood on their hands than any other terrorist group in the history of modern-day terror.
Right. And I think that's a huge part of why they have such a Israel, at least the leadership of Israel now, really doesn't like Iran. And so basically these series of incidents was Hezbollah's sort of emergence on the world stage.
It was. It took us a while to figure that out, but we eventually were able to connect the dots back and draw that link from the IJO, the Islamic Jihad Organization, to Hezbollah and ultimately to Iran.
So they've, aside from Bill Buckley, they were kidnapping Americans in Beirut for a number of years, right?
Yeah, at one point in time, I think we had almost 30 hostages. We had Lieutenant Colonel Rich Higgins, who was a Marine that was kidnapped and executed by Hezbollah. We had Bill Buckley, the story that I chronicle in Beirut Rules. We had the Archbishop of Canterbury, Terry Waite, that was kidnapped. We had Father Martin Jinko, a Catholic priest. We had Charlie Glass, who was an ABC News correspondent. Terry Anderson, who worked for the Associated Press. The list just goes on and on. And we had a whole bunch of American professors at American University Beirut that were also kidnapped, as well as French, German, Italian, Korean, and Russian citizens were also kidnapped by the same group.
So I'd heard, I forget where I heard this, that they'd kidnapped some Russians. And then in response, the Russians sent their special forces in there and they killed a bunch of people. And then that was sort of the end of them kidnapping Russians. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there's a slight variant of that, John. Basically, the Russian KGB started kidnapping family members of the hostage takers and threatened to send body parts back if they did not release the Russian diplomats. So, but the Russians certainly played, with a very heavy hand once their diplomats were kidnapped in Beirut. They threatened to send fingers and hands back and so forth if their diplomats were not, released. And the Russian diplomats were released.
Wow. So it was successful.
Yes, it was successful. It, much different strategy than what the United States would have done or we did do.
Right, right. And what were we doing? Were we sending money? Is that what we did?
Well, unbeknownst to those of us working the hostage problem, we had the National Security Council was sending TOW missiles and cash in exchange for hostages. But, you know, our mission was to try to get Bill Buckley, the CIA station chief, out of captivity. But unfortunately, John, he had been beaten and tortured to the point that, you know, he died of pneumonia while in captivity. We just did not know that. So, you know, I'm not going to point fingers over that strategy by any stretch of the imagination. I think most of us, if we were presented with the same problem, would do anything to get our family and loved ones back. And I think that they were trying to do everything they possibly could, you know, to get Bill Buckley brought home, because, you know, he was such a critical, you know, intelligence asset, as being, you know, the most senior CIA intelligence officer in Beirut at the time. So, you know, we were trying to move heaven and earth to get Bill back. We just lacked the human intelligence to know exactly where he was.
How long was he in captivity?
He was in captivity a little over a year before he died. And we don't know the exact date that he died. But if you fast forward, you know, a few years later, we were able to recover his body in 1991, along with the remains of Lieutenant Colonel Rich Higgins, the Marine that also had been kidnapped and murdered by the same group.
And how did that happen?
We utilized some back channels that we were working within the Lebanese at the time. We were offering a lot of reward money to bring their remains home, or to at least tip us off. And we were successful in finally bringing them home, where they could, you know, have proper resting grounds for eternity.
Right. So, touching on this topic, it's, you know, I think it's important to also speak about Iran, as they're responsible for a lot of this. And the U.S. has had a complicated relationship with Iran, probably dating back to the 50s. And then going forward, after the revolution in 79, as I understand it, the revolution came about. There was a lot of young students who were really passionate about bringing changes to the country and sort of not living under a dictatorship style system. And then they kind of got out of the fire and went into the frying pan, so to speak.
Well, when you're looking at Iran, and we actually had the original case file in our office from the 79 embassy takeover. And I interviewed one of the agents that were there. He was kind of a legend in our service. And he actually helped in our Benghazi story as well, because of the hostage aspect of that. We've never gotten it right from a foreign policy perspective, John. And I don't know why. I was a guy that was down in the weeds. I was an agent doing interviews and putting together investigations. You know, I'm not engaged in diplomacy by any stretch of the imagination, but it seems like the Iranians are always playing chess and we're playing checkers. And, you know, they've been able to kill a lot of Americans, never be held accountable for it, in my eyes. And they certainly pose a strategic threat to the state of Israel that is somewhat frightening. So, you know, I know that Iran is, you know, number one on Israel's intelligence collection list, and rightfully so. I mean, we have the ability to have great distance, and our geography doesn't, you know, put us in direct harm's way. But, you know, Iran certainly has enough clout in the Middle East to create chaos for us, the Saudis, the Israelis, the Emiratis, and the list is long. So I'm not overly optimistic that any administration is going to be able to ever figure Iran out.
Yeah, it seems like they are absolutely committed to doing anything they can to make life harder for the United States and also the countries that you named, Israel, probably at the top of the list. And it seems like since, you know, kind of talking about policy and things like that, since 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, their influence has only grown in the Middle East.
Without a doubt, which is frightening to you know, the old graybeards like me, because of we remember Bill Buckley, we remember the U.S. embassies lying in rubble, you know, we remember Lieutenant Colonel Rich Higgins, we remember the 79 embassy takeover and our hostages, you know, held for a year. So you know, and nuclear Iran is frightening. Now, on the flip side, you know, some would say that, you know, others would say that, well, a nuclear Iran, you know, ensures that no one would ever attack Iran. You know, I'm not so sure about that. I'm kind of scared to death of the thought of the mullahs getting their hands on a nuclear weapon. And I'm sure the Israeli intelligence service, you know, has plans for that to never happen.
Right. Well, it's since come out that they've run a highly successful, basically assassination campaign against their scientists, and they've bombed facilities that they were, you know, supposedly doing things to turn the nuclear energy, like to weaponize it, basically. And Israel is very on top of it. And from what if I can recall correctly, after the towers fell and the U.S. was focused on Afghanistan, I think that Iran had something to do with hooking the U.S. up with the Northern Alliance. And I think there was some kind of opportunity there to sort of have better relations. But then there was some sort of political saber rattling on the side of the U.S. And then after the invasion of Iraq took place, and even right before it, Iran was setting up to make life harder for the U.S. Once Saddam was removed from power.
Yeah, that gets back to the great game that they're playing, John. And that's to my point of Iran playing chess. They not as bad as the Chinese with the long view. But if you look at Iran's strategy since 79, it's been fairly consistent. And They've managed to just tie us in knots from just a foreign policy perspective and almost dictate, you know, us, you know, responding in a very reactive mode, not in a proactive capacity.
Right. And then there was it's kind of still some of the fallout from this is still taking place, where they had an agreement that Obama had signed, and then Trump had walked it back. And, you know, now it seems like tensions are rising again. But it's almost hard to, believe anything that they say regarding them doing things where they're not trying to sort of stick their thumb in the face of the U.S. or Israel or anybody else, really.
Oh, without a doubt. And they have a very formidable, very capable intelligence service. They're just as good as the Israeli Mossad or the CIA. They have an extraordinarily cyber capacity. They're very good at hacking. They're really good at human intelligence operations. So, you know, the money that the Obama administration shipped back to Iran, you know, was used to bolster the IRGC and the Ministry of Intelligence and Security. So, you know, this is a force that in the shadows that, you know, we will always be dealing with over the next 20 years. I mean, I tell our analysts here at Stratfor all the time, the younger ones, I mean, you guys have got a job for life because, you know, the Middle East and Iran will always be around. The Israeli-Palestinian problem will always be there. You know, Iran will always be causing trouble and mayhem. And it's called job security.
Yeah, for sure. Even right now, I mean, they're having huge protests all across the country, and the internet is basically shut down in Iran so that the things that are happening there won't get out to the rest of the world.
Yeah, they're very good at that too, and they have, you know, their cyber actors are, as evidenced by what we're seeing, very similar to what you'll see take place in China from time to time. So that just goes to show you, you know, the scope of their mindset and just the oppressive society that they live in.
Right, right, and that's why, you know, I feel like in '79 they kind of thought that they were getting out from under the thumb of a dictatorship. But they kind of just rolled right into a different kind of dictatorship, so to speak.
Yeah, and you're either one of them inside the security services or the ministries, or you're not. You know, it's from what we understand and watch here at Stratfor, you know, the country does have a lot of problems with employment and so forth, healthcare. You know, they do reward those that are loyal to the mullahs and to the IRGC and the intelligence services. And it's a tough, hard target for the U.S. to go after and the Five Eyes nations to kind of target.
And is it tough because they're so sort of closed off and it is like a dictatorship? Is that what makes it hard?
Yes, without a U.S. embassy footprint inside, makes it difficult for intelligence collection purposes. So that's also a problem. But they also have a very good counterintelligence service, you know, that are looking for defectors and so forth. So, like a few years back, a few of their scientists were assassinated. You know, some have alleged it was the CIA and the Mossad that was targeting them.
Right.
Well, they just clamped down and just refused to let their scientists travel. So, you know, they can shift and adapt accordingly.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about there seems to be a shift in U.S. foreign policy under this administration. Do you think that there is a serious change taking place?
I think that any administration that comes in always has policy shifts, like we were talking about with the Obama administration shipping the plane load of cash to Iran. You know, that's NSC driven. That's policy driven by the National Security Council. So, you know, that doesn't surprise me in the least. I think if you forecast out, and I don't know if President Trump will win again or not, but you know, we can anticipate change in foreign policy just because a president has much more latitude in your ability to deal with international events than you do with domestic events where there's so much oversight. So
Right. There's
actually much more leeway from a foreign policy perspective, you know, being dictated and driven out of the National Security Council or the Oval Office.
Right, right. Versus, right, domestic, there's so many different things and hoops you got to go through. But foreign, you can just say, this is what I want to happen and this is what happens.
That's correct.
So as far as like some of this, the shifts or what is starting to look like different shifts, it looks like some of the traditional alliances the United States has had may not be like a complete split, but it's looking like the U.S. is kind of going in a slightly different direction. I know that when Trump was campaigning, he was sort of pushing back against the idea of the U.S. supporting NATO so much financially and in other ways as well. I'm not sure how much actual change has taken place, but I know he's just vocalized some of these ideas that he's had regarding that.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, you know, when you start thinking about it. I mean, some of the rumblings we hear out of the Middle East are that You know, the Trump administration has certainly, you know, hooked their horse to the Saudi wagon with which to, you know, is caused a lot of consternation to, for example, the Emiratis and the Jordanians, and then the NATO issue. But, you know, also, I think it's important to understand that, you know, just because what is said publicly at times doesn't necessarily mean that the agents and the intelligence community are not doing their job.
Right.
I mean, you know, to be quite blunt, when I was an agent, yeah, you know, you had policy guidance, but we all kind of still did our job. And, you know, I have faith and confidence in the agents and the analysts in the military that they're doing their job. And, you know, generals will come and go, and political appointees will come and go. But, you know, the folks down in the weeds are still getting the job done.
Right. And I think that's an interesting point, because I feel like since the end of World War II, obviously there's differences in presidents and things like that, and directors of the CIA and, you know, head of the Pentagon and everything. But I feel like for the most part, the U.S. foreign policy has moved in a similar direction since the end of World War II up till now.
Yeah, you're going to have, you know, your great power shifts and competition between Russia and China, which will never go away. You know, I talk about this all the time. I don't think the Cold War really ever ended.
Right.
So, you know, that's always going to be out there, and always going to be the kind of issues that, from a strategic perspective, we're going to have to deal with. But, you know, on the flip side, you know, the you know, a nuclear Iran and Israel decides to strike, you know, the whole world could be on fire in very short order. You know, once other nation states kind of cause problems, and then we're reacting to them instead of getting in front of them.
Right. And I think that's another interesting point as well, because I feel like one incident that could take place in several areas on the planet could lead to a larger wars and potentially a third world war. And I'm not sure how much people realize that is a possibility.
Well, big wars start in small places.
Right. Right. So if anybody listening wants to check you out or get a hold of any of your books, where's the best place that they can do some of that? Like social media, Amazon?
Social media is the best place to look. You can find me on Twitter at Fred_Burton. You can obviously visit the Stratfor Worldview website. And I also have my own website, which is officialfredburton.com. Love to hear from any of your listeners.
And can you drop the names, the titles of your books, just in case people want to pick those up as well?
Absolutely. My first book is called Ghost. My second book is Chasing Shadows. My third book is Under Fire. That's the one about Benghazi. And then my last book, or my most current book, is called Beirut Rules.
Okay, awesome. It was great talking to you. I really do appreciate you coming on here. I know that the audience is going to have good takeaways and value from our discussion, as people are interested in counterterrorism and geopolitics around the world.
John, thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.